Welcome to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm Scott Greenberg. We usually think of science as the antidote to doubt, the place where mystery goes to become fact. However, Stuart Feierstein is a professor of neuroscience at Columbia University, a member of the Santa Fe Institute, and a Guggenheim Fellow. He argues that we may actually have that backwards.
His new book is called It Could Be Otherwise, Science in the Age of Uncertainty. It takes that idea further. Stuart Feierstein argues that science was never in the business of telling us what must be true, rather than locking us into a fixed fate. Real science keeps the future open and helps us tell it apart from the kind of science that only pretends to have all of the answers. Professor Feierstein, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. What a great idea to be on something called Cool Science. I have to say that.
I'm glad that you say that, because we think science is pretty cool and we love talking about it. And we realize a lot through hosting this show that the scientific method, let's call it, is not necessarily what most people think it is. I mean, most people think scientists are there to prove theories, but that's not so. It's that they're failing to disprove theories. It's all kind of backwards. Can you give us a good introduction to that?
I can give you my rant about it. That's the
We like the rants.
So the scientific method is actually, I believe it was developed, if I'm not mistaken, as a teaching tool. I don't actually know any scientists that use the so-called scientific method. And my objection to, sometimes we use it retrospectively. You make a discovery, you find something out, often by accident or by searching around someplace that you weren't expecting things. And then you may go back and use this kind of scientific method-y idea to be sure you've got it right somehow or another. But for the most part, my main objection is to the use of the word method. If there was a method, if there was a recipe, this would all be a lot simpler than it is. And there is no method and there is no recipe. And it's a mistake, I think, not only to teach science that way or to inculcate that value in some scientists who still believe that, but also to kind of not exactly lie, but to not be truthful with the public that science is just a recipe. You know, you put in the hypothesis here, you turn the crank a while, you get some data and out pop some facts and a new hypothesis and good, that's it. A day's work and we'll go home now, start again tomorrow. And I don't think that's the way it goes is the problem. I don't know anybody who actually does science that way.
Right. Well, I feel like this has become so much more of a public-facing question. Really, I'll dare to say, since COVID, when people were really trying to, there was all kinds of misinformation, disinformation swirling about, but the average person really wanted to get to the bottom of this. And as the vaccine was being manufactured and tested, we wanted to know things. We wanted to have answers. And this is when perhaps science came to light as something that doesn't necessarily have the answers. And there are iterations of the answers that can constantly be disproved. And so
made better. I mean, the idea is that we have what I would call provisional truths, which is actually a term that I think was coined to some extent by a philosopher of science named Catherine Elgin, who wrote a book called True Enough. And that's what she claims science is. And she's right about that, that science is rarely better than true enough. But that's often really quite good. COVID's an interesting example, I think. Science really came to bat there, in my opinion. Within 3 days of the first reported case of COVID, we had the genome sequence. Within 3 weeks, we had a structure of the virus. That's a remarkable achievement. I mean, that's unsurpassed time. What happened after that then? What happened? I mean, within less than a year, we had a vaccine that was 90% effective. I mean, very few vaccines are 90% effective. And we had one within a year that had gone through trials, had been developed. And yet somehow or another, there was this hiccup that happened between all this fabulous science that came together internationally around the world. Scientists worked together, didn't worry about publishing first or any of that kind of stuff. And yet there was this hiccup when it got out to the public. There were mistakes made, And I think some of it was the fault of science, some of it the fault of politicians, and some of it just a few charlatans that are always around to muck up the good stuff, you know. But I think there's that disconnect was important. And I would say that's at least partly the fault of scientists, yes. I'll give you a quick example, if I may. So we were all thrilled, the science community, about this mRNA business, right? That we had this mRNA technology that we had largely ignored for years, suddenly was available to produce this great new vaccine. So we're touting it and exalting it and everything, forgetting that the general public, almost anybody who's not a trained biologist, is not going to know the difference between mRNA or DNA or, you know, tRNA or cDNA or all the acronyms we use for genes. And we've been telling people for years, oh, we shouldn't be meddling with your genes. You shouldn't meddle with genes. And now we're saying, well, let's just, you know, pump some genes into your arm. How's that sound to you? And of course, there was a backlash to that. And it was our fault for not thinking it through, it seems to me, among many other problems.
Well, I am a product of science of the 80s. And actually, my master's in science had a strong background in neuroscience. So kind of feel like we're colleagues in a way. But yeah, I'm just trying to imagine going to my mentors, my professors, and saying, oh, that's true enough. That's not the way I certainly was trained. I doubt I would have been able to pass any exams based on the true enough theory. But I am curious, in your own journey along this line of kind of turning what I believe is the scientific method, how I've been raised, a little bit on its head, was there a specific moment in your research when you personally ran into maybe the limits of certainty?
It's hard to pinpoint any one particular moment. I would say, to be really thoughtful about it, that it's always the case, or virtually always the case. I mean, we write a paper, we publish it because we believe it's, quote, true, knowing that it will be superseded, if not by us, by another laboratory that will come in and do the next bit of work and take it a little further. So my feeling is that's always been part of the process, or that's the way the process should work. Now, yes, I know scientists who run much tighter labs than I do, I suppose, and who insist on nailing down every little bit of work, every little piece of it. I don't trust them. I honestly don't trust data that looks too good. I worry that somebody's been pressured into it, that somebody's been pushed a little bit, that somebody's cherry-picked data. I mean, in biology especially, I have to say the noise is where the data is. The noise is the interesting part of it. That may not be true in physics or chemistry or some of the so-called hard sciences, where we try and get rid of the noise and just look at the signal. But in biology, there's an awful lot of information in the noise. That's just how biology is.
So let's talk about a little bit about soft science, biology, for example. I think part of the beauty of science is sometimes just getting it wrong and finding out that we've got it wrong, and it continues. To me, science is a continuum of experiment, fail, maybe we get it right, maybe we get it wrong, or maybe even our hypothesis and the theories that we proved were faulty to begin with. Is this kind of the premise that you're going along with in saying, listen, science isn't perfect, and sometimes we have to go backwards to go forward?
I think that's a perfect way of stating it. I think failure is one of the most useful parts of science for a couple of reasons. One is we don't claim to be infallible. Infallibility belongs to, I don't know, the Pope and maybe a couple of other characters around the world, you know, something like that. But in science, we don't do that. We don't believe we're infallible. And there's a certain kind of rejection of authority. There's a wonderful phrase from Francis Bacon, who some claim you could claim is the father of the scientific revolution. I don't want you to think I read all of Francis Bacon, but I happen to find this quote, which is, he said, previously, truth came from authority. Henceforth, authority will come from truth. Now, that's a big idea in just a few words. So truth is not just going to come from the church, the government, the state, whoever's in charge, Aristotle, whatever you like. We're going to do experiments. We're going to find out. We're going to get data. And of course, most experiments fail, and they should, because then you know the ones that worked are probably reliable. I wouldn't trust something that didn't fail enough. That's one important part of failure. The second part is that if you think science is about what we don't know, which I think we could all probably agree on, we're interested in what we don't know in science, and so that's what we're after, then How do you get to the really deep unknown, what I would call the unknown unknown, the stuff we don't even know we don't know? Well, I think there's only one way to get there, and that's failure. You do an experiment because you don't know something and you think it's going to show you that, and then it doesn't work. It fails in some way. Either you get no result or you get the wrong result, what you think is the wrong result. And now you realize, oh, there was something I didn't know. I better go back there and figure out what that is. And so that's that portal into the really deepest kind of ignorance, if you will, the deepest kind of unknown there is. So failure is critical, not just because you learn something from it. It's an integral part of the process.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Stuart Feierstein, and he is talking to us about his new book about scientific uncertainty. It's called It Could Be Otherwise, Science in the Age of Uncertainty. Is it that it's really hard to say that you're uncertain about something that you've been working on, researching for perhaps years or decades, that you can come to the point as a scientist to say, but it could be otherwise?
I mean, that gets said an awful lot in laboratories, in lab meetings at least. And it gets said now and again at conferences as well. There's a wonderful anecdote about Harry Truman, former president, who was not that colorful, so there aren't that many anecdotes from him. But he was one of the first presidents, he was the first president, I believe, to have a science advisor at a very high level, not quite cabinet, but nearly cabinet level. And he was once heard to remark to one of his aides, he said, could somebody please find me a one-handed scientist? And the reason was that he would get all this advice from some scientist who at the end of it would say, but on the other hand, and then give him a completely different set of advice, right? And that's, you know, that's what science is. Yeah, on the one hand, it's this. On the other hand, it could be that. And, you know, in the end, two hands are better than one. I think what we need to realize is that the more expert you are in an area, the more uncertain you are. So it's the experts who are the closest to uncertainty because they see the holes, they see the missing data, they see the alternative hypotheses. As you move away from expertise, you don't see all of those sort of scraggly bits. You know, you just see a nice paper published and a newspaper report about it, and we're on our way to curing cancer, which never seems to happen somehow or another. So I think uncertainty is a deeply held part of science that is, and one that we want to protect, because that uncertainty is full of possibilities.
Yeah.
That's where the possibilities are, right?
There has been, let's see, we've been doing Cool Science Radio for maybe 12 or 13 years now. Wow. And we've noticed just a proliferation of people, of science communicators, of people who maybe have advanced degrees in scientific fields, but decided, guess what? I'm a good communicator and I want to talk to people about this stuff. If we think about, you know, the person that comes to mind first, Neil deGrasse Tyson, astrophysicist that knows how to talk to people and can bring people into being curious lay people is what we always say on this show. But how has science communication both served and maybe compromised scientific uncertainty?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's a tough question because I think science that's not communicated to the public is science lost. I mean, if it's locked up in the laboratory, who cares? You know, it has to be out in the public. But that doesn't mean that the public needs to become scientific experts themselves in every field. I mean, I'm not a scientific expert in physics. I'm a neurobiologist. There's an awful lot of genetics I can't tell you anything about. I can't even read a paper on it because I can't understand it. So expertise is something that you can't expect everybody to have. But I think you can participate in science. I think you can enjoy science. I think you can understand the process of science quite easily without having expertise in any particular technical area of science. I think there are relatively straightforward ways of communicating science that we do need to take more care of. I think part of the problem is that we rely on scientists, the few scientists, to do this. And it's not part of your training as a scientist. You know, that's just not what you're trained to do. And so when you're suddenly asked to do it, you often get it wrong, I'm afraid. There are a few people who are good at it, and they often pay the price for it. Neil is a good point. I mean, you know, he's not as well respected in the astrophysics field as he could be if he didn't make the decision to be a science communicator and say, okay, I don't care. I don't care what you think of me. I mean, Carl Sagan had the same problem. Carl Sagan was a good planetary astronomer, astrophysicist, but he was looked down upon by the scientific community because he spent all his time or much of his time communicating science to the public. Meantime, thousands of people are scientists today because of Carl Sagan. So I think that's important work. But I think you have to be trained for it. I mean, I think we have to think about how to train people to do that. Communication, I mean, you know, you do it. You're doing communication. And there are skills. There are ways of knowing an audience. There are skills about how to talk to an audience, how not to talk down, but not to talk over an audience. I mean, all of these sorts of things, how to listen as well as talk. So there are lots of things like that that scientists don't get much training in. In fact, they get almost the opposite training. What we're supposed to do is go to a conference and argue as vociferously as we can for our perspective, for our data, for our point of view, right? That's fine at a scientific conference where it's a boxing match, but it's not such a good way to communicate with the public.
I want to circle back to the concept of certainty and uncertainty, and I loved it. I love the idea of maybe the more uncertain we are, maybe the better the science is. And I can give you an example of the opposite, where somebody was so certain about something, and I don't want to touch the political third rail here, but as an example, there was a famous paper that linked autism to vaccines. And it has been debunked. The author has been defrocked of his licenses. And this was ages ago, and yet still today. And this was something that was, and I'm going to air quote here, certain. It was a paper written with certainty that still haunts us today and is still in the public mind and won't go away. So there is, I think, a certain danger to your point of this certainty. And maybe we need to embrace the uncertain. And I'd love for you to maybe give me other examples of maybe being uncertain is in our best interest.
Oh, well, I think there are, I mean, I think almost everything we do should be with a touch of uncertainty. That science works, in my opinion, a kind of an amalgamation of hubris and humility. You have to have a certain hubris to do science because you fail a lot and you're actually looking for the deepest secrets in nature. I mean, really, are we going to get that? Are we smart enough to figure this out? Would Newton have done what Newton did, tried to figure out what kept the planets in orbit and how gravity worked, if he didn't have a certain amount of hubris? But at the same time, we all should, and most do, have quite a bit of humility about what it is we actually do know compared to the vast amount that we don't know, the vast amount that's left to be known, which is great because it keeps us employed. So that's a good thing. And I think that's what's important, is this recognition that whatever we know today, how can I say it? I like to say that in science, revision is a victory, that everything that goes out there should be expected to be revised. I mean, I assume that every paper I've ever written that's come out of my laboratory will undergo some kind of revision in the future. I don't think it will be totally wrong. I don't think anything we put out there was totally wrong. But I don't think it was the full picture either. I think there's some things we didn't have the technology to see or didn't have the technique or didn't know about other experiments that have occurred or new data that's occurred in the meantime that throw a different light on what we saw then. And so there has to be, science has to be dynamic. It can't just be an encyclopedia. And I think that means that it embraces uncertainty because uncertainty is where all those possibilities are. So yes, I think the danger is anybody who tells you they're certain about anything, you should get away from them as quickly as you can. They're just trying to sell you something because no scientist will ever claim they're totally certain about something.
In this current age, though, this age that we're living in of skepticism towards scientific institutions, isn't the quote of, hey, we're really not entirely sure, end quote, a risky thing for scientists to say publicly now?
Well, I guess it is, but it shouldn't be. I mean, we do say it in some ways. Well, maybe we don't say it so clearly. Let me give you a quick example, all right? So there are currently 9 different kinds of blood pressure medicine that you can take if you're hypertensive. So we have 9 ways of treating blood pressure that use different mechanisms. The fact is we do not know what regulates blood pressure. So 90% of hypertensive diagnoses are what are called idiopathic, which means we don't know what caused it. We don't know why you have high blood pressure because we don't understand blood pressure entirely, but we can treat it. And so that's the uncertainty side of science. Now, just because we're not certain about how blood pressure works, do you want to give your blood pressure medicine back? I don't. I'm taking it. Thank you. And the same thing is true of you know, medicines for almost every disease we have. We don't understand the root cause of many of these pathologies and illnesses, but I'm taking the medicine, thank you. And eventually, I think there'll be better treatments for blood pressure, either better medicines or things besides medicine.
Well, it makes me think, Stuart, about maybe we're in this age of we're caught between proactive and reactive and treating the cause and not the symptoms. And as consumers, and as you were talking about blood pressure medication, I started to think about statins. And I had a friend who did not want to go on statins, did not want to, very healthy, but had this high cholesterol. I heard overheard another friend talking to her about you really need to research what all the elements are going into that's giving you high cholesterol before you do statins. And in the meantime, cholesterol sticking to her arteries, you know? So in a way, we are in a great age where we as consumers are starting to have more inquiry into this and say, I want to prevent rather than treat. But with that said, what are the caveats for consumers to, you know, believe, trust, and all of that?
It's a tough world out there for consumers. I agree. There's just this flood of information. You have to be very careful about what the sources of it are. It's very difficult. I mean, you know, you look at Google now. It used to be that you would search something on Google and you really wouldn't use anything past page one or maybe page two. The rest of it was, you know, they give you 39 million hits that it had, but you'd never go to them. Now you rarely use anything on page one because they're all sponsored ads. And I don't think they're trustworthy as a result of that. And if somebody's trying to sell you something, whether it's, you know, for money or for your participation, it's a potential problem. How you get through this is very difficult. I mean, I blame to a large extent our current way of educating people in science. From K through, not only K through 12, but all the way through undergraduate university. We teach science as an accumulation of facts. We teach it as certainty. There's only one right answer on the exam, and that's what you should expect. And so, you know, when people are faced with a pandemic and they go to science, they think, well, don't you guys have the answer? What are you telling me? It's 80% or it's 60-40 or this or that. I mean, I want to know, what should I do here? I don't blame them. We've taught them to ask exactly that question. But that's not what science really can do. I mean, science can inform. I don't think it should ever prescribe. So if what you want to be is informed, that's good. If you're waiting for somebody to prescribe something to you, that's a little more dangerous.
Who is your book for?
Ah, everybody. Everybody.
Curious lay people.
Yes. Yes. And I hope science students, there were two books that came out before this one. One is called, I'm sorry, I'm going to plug them now quickly, but one is called Ignorance, What Drives Science? And the other is called Failure, Why Science is So Successful. So I have this little niche market on ignorance and failure cornered there. And one of the gratifying things about those two books I found out was that high school science teachers use them quite a bit. And I didn't write them for high school science teachers or high school students. I just kind of wrote them for general public, reasonably well-educated, but general public. And then it turned out that they were of interest to high school students in science classes. I find that very gratifying. So I hope this one does the same thing. I think we often underestimate, we think we have a scientifically illiterate population, but we don't really. We're quite literate scientifically. I mean, the average high school student today, they don't even have to be an A student. Just the average high school student today knows more science than Isaac Newton knew. We're pretty advanced, really. You know, we use technology all the time quite easily. I mean, we may not understand it, but, you know, not everybody understands Newton either or anything else. I mean, and you can use it, but we're quite comfortable with technology, with our iPhones or any phone you have, with our computers, with all sorts of technologies. And we live quite well with them. So I think we're fairly literate, actually. Literacy is not the problem. It's an attitude issue, I think. It's a way of thinking about science that, as I say, I think science itself is as guilty of promoting as anybody else.
Well, the book is titled It Could Be Otherwise, Science in the Age of Uncertainty. Stuart Feierstein is our guest. He's a professor of neuroscience at Columbia University, a member of the Santa Fe Institute, and a Guggenheim Fellow. Stuart, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you both. This was a great conversation. Fabulous. Thank you so much.